My name is Corey Sands. I'm 44 years old, and today is Wednesday, February 26, 2020. We are here in Fresno, California. I am with my dad, H. Spees.
And I am H. Spees. I'm 67 years old. Today is Wednesday, February 26, 2020. We're here in Fresno, the center of the universe, and I am being interviewed by my daughter.
All right. So, Dad, I thought this would be a great opportunity to record some thoughts from you. And so I just wanted to ask you some questions sort of detailing your life and decisions you've made and your marriage, because you have some major legacy things that you've done already. And I know you have big plans to come. So I just wanted to record some of your thoughts about how things have gone so far.
Sounds like fun.
Okay. So when is the earliest you can remember knowing what you wanted to do with your life?
Well, that's a great question. I think it's changed. I think the thing that has been a constant is I knew I wanted to have a public life, and I knew that I wanted to make a difference in the world. I grew up in the 60s. I was born in 1953 to Depression-era parents and who were benefiting from the upwardly mobile rise of folks after World War II. Mm-hmm. And in the 60s, you had Martin Luther King, you had John F. Kennedy, you had all these huge charismatic personalities and a ton of change socially. And I knew I wanted to be a part of that.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So what was the most important decision that you think you made early that set your trajectory?
Well, one decision that I didn't make is that I was born in a stable family to parents who were just great parents. And so as I've seen over the course of years how rare that is. Mm-hmm. But the decisions that I made, I think, were to really get involved. So I ran for office. I was student body president. Mm-hmm. I invested in achievement. I was a student athlete. I got good grades. I kind of was on that upwardly mobile mm-hmm. ladder. And it was, I think, probably the biggest decision that I made was there were three decisions that kind of played into each other. One was a decision to follow Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And that was a fairly radical decision because that actually led me to some places that caused my parents great concern. but that's another part of the story. The second decision was to marry your mother, mm-hmm. Because I had no idea that I was marrying an adventurer, and so our life, in her words, would be we got off track early. Mm-hmm. And the third decision was to go to Mississippi right after the Civil Rights Movement and to work in low-income African-American communities led by folks who had literally been beaten almost to death mm-hmm. by Mississippi Highway Patrolmen and Sheriff's deputies for registering people to vote. Mm-hmm. So that decision kind of led me off of a wonderful cliff. Hmm. I had gone 2 years to USC. Growing up in Los Angeles, you know, the whole reason for my bipolar nature is that I went 2 years to UCLA and USC and then transferred to UCLA, primarily because I got married at 19. We got married at 19, and we couldn't afford the private school in the ghetto, so we invested in the public school in Westwood, right? But after 3 years of three straight years, consecutive years at the university and being accepted for my final year at Berkeley, I dropped out. And we went to live in Mississippi for 11 years. And my parents thought that we'd joined some sort of religious cult. 10 years later, I got my degree and finished up and what have you. But I think back to your mother's terms, we got off track early. Mm-hmm. And that off-trackness was a source of incredible adventure and liberation.
Mm-hmm. That's what I anticipated you were going to say. So along the way of going off track, according to other people's definition of being on track, who are your best role models?
So we became part of an organization called Voice of Calvary Ministries, which was a comprehensive community development, faith-based community development work that was doing housing, it was doing health care, it was doing church planting, it was doing evangelism, it was doing education. And the two people that led that were John and Vera Mae Perkins, and they were remarkable people. They had grown up in Mississippi during the time when people were lynched, people were mm-hmm. killed. John Perkins' oldest brother, Clyde, had returned from war in 1946, a Purple Heart veteran, and returned to Mississippi and was shot by the sheriff in a small town called New Hebron, where they grew up. And that led to John's family sending him for his safety to California. So that was 1946. He was 16 years old. He grew up in California. He married his sweetheart, Vera Mae, also from Mississippi. They had escaped poverty. They had escaped the violence. They had escaped the racism. They were having a middle-class life in Monrovia near Pasadena, California. Great jobs. And then he had a radical spiritual conversion as a result of seeing his son come home from church with joy, something that he'd never known. He was in incredible poverty, grew up in incredible poverty in Mississippi. And so that led to him beginning to spend time with juvenile delinquents in the juvenile justice camps in the San Dimas Mountains and in Southern California. And he realized that a lot of those kids had Mississippi and Alabama in their voices. Mm-hmm. He realized that the problem of the urban ghetto in Los Angeles was in many ways the unsolved problem of the South. Mm-hmm. And he just felt this great calling to go back to Mississippi. His wife said, absolutely not. Are you crazy? And long story short, he took ill, and she got down on his next to his bed and said, God, if you will spare my husband, I will go to Mississippi with him. I mean, it's just dramatic. I mean, it's like stuff that movies are written about. And that's the quality of people that they were. They came back to the South. They spent time investing in kids in that time in segregated schools. Mm-hmm. They were speaking to 10,000 young people a month in black schools. Mm. And they returned in 1960, which was a pivotal time. Mississippi was the belt buckle of the Bible Belt, but also it was the last bastion of racism in the South. And so they ended up becoming the leaders of when the Civil Rights Movement finally got to Mississippi. They were chosen because they were the most well-connected to kids and their families. And that led them on a huge, challenging time that was very, very dramatic. And John Perkins was, like I said, beaten along with 21 other folks in a jailhouse in Brandon, Mississippi, by law enforcement, and almost lost his life, lost two-thirds of his stomach, had a heart attack. And then they had all these wonderful breakthroughs, and but they stayed put, they kept at it, and they applied principles that later became known as Christian community development. the idea of relocating to the community of need and allowing the people with the challenges to lead in the solutions and to bridge racial, cultural, economic barriers and to redistribute resources in a way that promoted justice. All these things for your mother and I were just unbelievable. I mean, they were just so authentic, real. They challenged our values, and they ultimately led us on the same track that just as the Perkins had become upwardly mobile black folk in Southern California and reversed that, we kind of got off the ladder for a purpose, that's been the story of our lives.
So you mentioned that Vera May was not real happy about going back to Mississippi, but I'd love to know what your conversation was like with Mom about going to Mississippi.
Well, she was actually up for that, but we had some other decisions along the way that were challenging, and she was remarkable. I mean, we went down together for a summer to serve, and she was the first nurse in the first health center, one of the first nurses in the first health center that we started during a summer trip. And so when the Perkins asked us, it wasn't just that they asked me and she was following me. It's that they asked both of us to stay. I was being useful in assisting John Perkins in writing and developing proposals and initiating projects. And Terry was helpful in the health center. And so the call came to us from them together, and together we said, yeah, we're going to stay. And that summer experience led to us moving there permanently, and that led to 11 years. But in the course of that time, what's happened over the course of time with this infusion of a sense of social justice and a call by God to embrace the most vulnerable in our society, which I mean, he left the most secure gated, you know, the Jesus story outside of middle class evangelicalism or whatever is that God left the most secure gated community in the universe, heaven, to come to our hood. And not just to come to our hood, but he was born to a couple that were homeless. There wasn't room in the inn. They became undocumented workers. I mean, so, and all of what I'm saying now is a theological lens that we did not pick up in Glendale, California, in in middle class Los Angeles. So we began to see the world differently. So part of that was that on your mother's life, there was this huge calling to include kids in our family that were not our own, that were the victims in many ways of the poverty and the oppression that we saw in our world. And so when she was pregnant with you, 6 months pregnant, still working at University Medical Center in Jackson, Mississippi, she came home one night after the night shift and said, I think the Lord's telling us to take Jimmy. Well, Jimmy was a kid that was born so poor, his family made soap out of lye. And he had gotten into the lye, had ingested it, had lost his esophagus. So he had a trach and a gastrostomy tube where he was fed and straight into his stomach. But then he had been put into a foster home where he was beaten almost to death. Huge subdural hematoma on the right side, so he's partially paralyzed on his left side. I'd been up there to play with him. But we're 22 years old, you're on the way, and I'm keeping the checkbook, and I say, sweetheart, you know, we've got one in the oven. I don't see it. And then she did what you all do when you want to get your way. She just was quiet. So I had to live with that. I had to sit with that, and I realized profoundly one night when I was praying and searching from 10 at night until about 3 in the morning that there was a profound call on her life, and I had the responsibility of either following that call on her life or crushing it. And God gave me a vision. And the vision was that there was this pathway. It was like decomposed granite tamped down. And over the pathway was a shower of water, showers. And I knew that that shower, those showers were money. And that the idea was, the thought was, the sense that I had, deep sense that I had, was that if I put my foot on that pathway, which was God's pathway in this world, that he was the God of the fatherless and the orphan and the vulnerable, that if I took that role on his behalf with my wife, that we would never lack resource. And so she got up in the morning and she said, and I said to her, let's do it. So Jimmy came home to be with us, and that was the first of about a dozen foster kids. And over the years, we were foster parents for 20 years. We adopted three, had three homegrown kids, and the rest is history, except that also she's then run three nursing homes for the most medically fragile kids in Fresno, California. So that whole branch of our family tree was born out of that crazy getting off track. And then the other side of it was, I had this deep sense that we were supposed to move a couple of times. One was to leave Jackson, where we'd established an incredible community of people that were doing great things in the city, the capital city of Jackson, Mississippi, to go to, actually to go to the hometown, the old hometown of John Perkins, which in 1946, his brother had been killed there. Now, flash forward 1979, an African-American church leader and a white pharmacist had come to John Perkins and said, we need your help establishing a health center. And he gave the job, John Perkins gave the job to the white guy from, the white kid from Los Angeles. And I told your mother, I think we need to move there. In order for this to be legit, we cannot recruit people from all over the country, doctors and nurses and dentists, to come if they don't have someone there who has done the cultural, cross-cultural work. Because, you know, we were putting together a health center with 6 black, 5 white on the board with a black chair. And she said, absolutely not. I'm not moved down to a town of 500 when we've worked hard over 5 years to build this community. This we had about 200, 300 people in our church, and it was great. And, but about a year later, she woke up and said, let's go. So that's happened a couple of times. Another time that that happened was here in Fresno. Years later, when I just had, I started waking up in the middle of the night and feeling like we needed to leave our suburban home in Clovis and move into the highest crime, lowest income neighborhood in Fresno. So that off-trackness, it goes both ways. And we kind of joke, we say, well, God uses me to help lead us to where we're going to live, and he uses your mom to fill the house, to determine who's going to be in the house. And, you know, so we had an empty nest up until about a year ago. And guess what? Now we have a 19-year-old living with us. So life goes on. It's been a wild ride.
Yes. So I'm imagining this isn't really what you envisioned life like when you were newly married. But what would you say, you know, what are some words you would describe that your life is different because you married Mom?
Well, stable, overflowing, risky. I mean, you know, here, you know, when you have kids who wake you up every 2 hours because they have to be suctioned because they're a drug baby who can't blink or swallow, you know, those types of situations take you to the end of yourself. And one time I just said, you know, you're going to have to help me understand why we're doing this. What do you see when you look at DeAndre? And she said, well, I see what nobody else sees because I'm with him all the time. I see the raw value of a human soul. And I said, okay, that's enough. That's what I got.
That's a good one. So what would you say is your favorite thing about Mom?
Well, I think, you know, her smile, her laugh, her, she is an introvert, and she would say about herself that she's scattered, but she is one of the most focused, determined, hardworking persons that I know. And she calls me up to be better than I could be on my own.
That's a good answer. Okay, so I like to refer to you. In fact, today when I was talking to someone at StoryCorps about you, I was trying to describe who you are and who you have been. And I said, well, I would say community activist, but that's sort of charged in several ways. But the words that came to my out of my mouth were, you're a community pro-activist. And so what would you call yourself in your work?
Well, what Mom calls me, she said, you know, I've been a public health administrator with the Fresno County Department of Health. Before that, in Mississippi, I set up a network of health centers, and so I was a healthcare administrator there. So a lot of my training is in public health. My master's is in public administration, health services administration. I've also been a pastor, having been a part of a faith-based group in Mississippi that was church-based. I was also called to be a part of leadership in the church and have had training in that, and at one point was pastor of a 3,000-member church. And now I ran for mayor, and lost, but supported the guy who came in second. I came in third. He won, and then he asked me to be director of strategic initiatives. So I've had a lot of back and forth between civic and nonprofits and faith-based and church. But what your mother would say is that I've been doing the same thing for 45 years. And she says it's grease and glue. So I think what that, and I think she's right. I think what it means is that I'm a leader. I was born that way. My parents, that's part of my parents' legacy. But because I've hung out with people like John and Vera Mae Perkins and many other people who have taught me to lead from below, I think what I do is I connect people across racial, cultural, geographic, political, ideological barriers for the common good. Whether that's reducing poverty, crime, and violence in order for a city, a community to flourish, whether that's to reduce human trafficking. Right now, one of the biggest projects that I'm working on is reducing homelessness in the city of Fresno. And Fresno has the highest concentrated poverty of any city in America. So, you know, it's leading from behind, it's leading from below, but it's valuing the human person and everybody. It's having a fierce commitment to follow Jesus Christ, who laid himself down for every single person, but without getting caught into the ideological lens that you have to judge the value of other people based on some religious metric. But I would say leading with others for the common good is what I do.
So what is one of the most important lessons that you've learned in all of this same direction work?
Well, it kind of ties in with what I just said. There's a woman by the name of Edna Hong, who is the foremost Kierkegaard scholar in America. And she wrote a little book called The Downward Ascent. And when I was doing my doctoral work, I did a doctoral work called Peace for Cities, Building a Christ-Centered Civic Renewal Network, a global Christ-Centered Civic Renewal Movement, or something like that. But I read this book, and what I discovered, Edna just got it. Hmm. And what it was is the downward ascent, is that the key to really, to radical transformational change for a leader is getting out of that upwardly mobile, positional, hierarchical quest for power and leadership. It is going down. And it's reversing the law of gravity. It is, instead of what goes up must come down, it's what goes down will come up. And I've seen that in terms of leadership. You look at John Greeley, if you look at Peter Block and John McKnight with asset-based community development, appreciative inquiry. You look at it in terms of Greenleaf wrote on servant leadership, and it is just about what Jesus said, is that he who would be great among you must become the slave of all. And that the power of that I saw worked out in the African American community in Mississippi, and then into a movement that became global, is probably closest to the core of what I believe in terms of action and leadership.
That's good. So is there anything in your work life that you would go back and change?
The things have not been easy. But that's not a reason that I would change anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do have this feeling that if we really do give our lives with abandon to follow God, that he will trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not rely on your own insight. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will direct your paths. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Jesus said, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, which also is translated justice, and all these things will be added unto you. So we've operated, because we got off track so early, and because I married somebody who's as flexible and radical as your mother, I think we've had the privilege to risk and do risky things that have cost us something, but have also had great payoffs. So I can't think of anything that I would do differently.
Let me ask you this other kind of question. Daniel Pink, I'm sure you've read some of his work, describes flow as the relationship between what a person had to do and what he could do was perfect, so deeply in the moment that their sense of time, place, and even self melted away. So when you're doing work, what kind of work creates that flow for you?
Well, when I think that when I... You know, there's this Chinese proverb that's similar to that. It says, go to the people, live among them, learn from them, love them, work with what they have, build on what they know. And when the best leaders have led, the people will say, we did it ourselves. minutes.
That's flow.
That's magic.
It is. It is magic.
And I've had a chance to see that, you know. And now at 67, what the great privilege is to watch you and our other children, now leaders, but also a whole other generation mm-hmm. of young people taking it and running with it mm-hmm. and not feeling like I need to grasp it or hold on to it or preserve some form of legacy that was mine. It's just, you know, I think the world is, we have some huge challenges to face, mm-hmm. but building community among people to together face those challenges is the flow. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's good. So I would say this is kind of my last question, and you've sort of alluded to this all the way along and have been building this, but if you could define what you would want your legacy to be, what you would want to be remembered for, what would you say?
You know, I have one of the things that as pastor, this is, you know, I'm going to riff a little bit here, but, you know, one of the things that snuck up on me as pastor is, you know, I would preach every Sunday morning to three huge services, and we had a large budget, and we had thousands of people. But the thing that snuck up on me is my very favorite thing was doing funerals. Mm. Because, you know, when you do a wedding, weddings are fun. But once the ring is on the finger, it's all about the cake, the dress, and the party. I mean, weddings are somewhat superficial, mm. but funerals, when people show up at funerals, they are open. Mm. They are ready. They are ready to hear. And it's a divine appointment. And what's amazed me, and I've done funerals for people who have zero money, mm-hmm. and where we just as the church offered hospitality and a banquet to their family, homeless people. And I've done funerals for the wealthiest people in America. But the amazing thing is one of the great things about doing a funeral is you get to sit, if you're really into it, is you sit with the family the night before the funeral, mm-hmm. because that everybody who is significant has come in mm-hmm. from out of town and they're there, and you help them tell the family story, mm-hmm. and you tell what made grandma who she was, what was her, and you kind of do it a little bit chronologically. Sometimes what families do is they say, well, let's get the kids. We'll put the kids out in the pool mm-hmm. and let them play so that you can do this real business. I say, no. They are the real business. Get them in here. Mm-hmm. We don't tell our family stories. We don't do what StoryCorps does here. We don't, our families, we're rootless in America in many ways. And so we tell the family story. And it's just amazing to me how rich or poor or whatever, the stories that the kids and the grandkids remember are, hey, grandpa would take us camping, mm-hmm. and he taught me how to put a hook mm-hmm. in the bait. And he and grandma would make blueberry waffles. Mm-hmm. And I can still smell her kitchen. Mm-hmm. And it has nothing to do with the achievement or the lack of achievement, or it is all about relationship and love and touch and family. And I think that's it. I'm actually interested at this stage of my life in nurturing the legacy of John Perkins. Mm-hmm. Because I think that, you know, I've followed him. Your mother and I have followed John and Vera May powerfully. They've been humble, incredible, wonderful servants. And I think that I assisted him in getting his first book written. Mm-hmm. And then I ghostwrote his second book based on transcripts that I did on a cassette player and with a portable typewriter before computers. And those stories and that movement, and I think they so powerfully picture a type of transformational life and relationship and leadership that I'm really interested in magnifying and preserving that legacy. So I wrote those two books in my 20s, now in my 60s, as he is now turning 90 this year, and she is also. I am I'm kind of nurturing a book that would maybe capture some of the principles and core to what made them great.
Awesome. Well, thank you for talking with me. And I want you to know that I'm proud of you and what you and Mom have done. And I'm grateful because it's shaped my life and my work and my family. So thank you.
We're proud of you.
Thank you.